The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, Dr. Richard Leakey has been immersed in paleoanthropology for over 50 years. He tells us what continues to surprise him about hominids and about the technology that could revolutionise the study of our ancestry. And we ask, how certain can we be that humans originated in East Africa? Plus, the potential role of aspirin in cancer treatment and the strife of the middle sibling. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Richard Leakey has had a variety of careers. From 1968 to 1999, he built up Kenya's national museums and led an international research effort studying human evolution within the Turkana Basin in northern Kenya. After this, he established the Kenya Wildlife Service and successfully stemmed the slaughter of elephants for their ivory. From conservation, he went into Kenya's politics, briefly sat in Kenya's parliament, and later became the head of Kenya's civil service and secretary to the cabinet. He has since developed the Turkana Basin Institute as a global centre of excellence for the study of human origins and vertebrate paleontology. The Guardian's Rowan Slaney caught up with him in London last week and began by asking Dr. Leakey to pick out what had been the most interesting paleoanthropological find of recent years.
I would be loath to pick out one find against another as more important. I think there have been many important finds, and in a funny way, each find builds on the importance of previous finds in that it gives you a greater insight either into the simplicity of the questions that you're asking or the complexity of the question that you're asking. And so in terms of personal satisfaction, the fact that we're getting new discoveries out of South Africa, Naledi, Sidibe, adding to the diversity of hominid types in Southern Africa as well as the diversity in East Africa, is to me very gratifying, because I think from the increased body of evidence, we will probably sort out some of the questions that have left us a bit surprised.
And what are those questions?
Well, we don't see Australopithecus africanus in East Africa, and you don't see the sort of early Homo habilis-like things in South Africa. We don't see afarensis in much of East Africa, and you don't see it at all in South Africa. So what was this distribution? And if there was this very wide distribution, at what point were they coming together? At which point could you look for a point at which another lineage springs out? So I don't think we've got enough evidence yet, but I think it's coming in fast and furious now, and I think we will get there quite soon now.
Has the picture of hominid evolution been changed by recent discoveries?
Well, in my lifetime, which is quite short, I've been practicing it for about 50 years now, paleoanthropology, I think we've moved from a position where, if you will, the total number of fossil specimens could fit on a small coffee table, to a situation now where to get all the specimens out onto one surface would require a fairly large-sized room and many tables. The accumulation of fossils is one thing, but the accumulation of data in which the fossils can be considered, ranging from isotope studies to genetic studies to... There's a multiplicity of high-tech work that's going on, and the tools that are now available, the scanning electron microscopy, the probes. It's extraordinary now how much further along we were than 50 years ago, and I think it's exponential, because even when we started my program at Lake Turkana, we didn't have access to the sort of approaches that are now available.
Do you still hold to the view that Homo sapiens came from East Africa, even though we've found specimens in not Homo sapiens but close relatives in South Africa?
Well, the story of Homo sapiens is a complex one, but if we believe the DNA story and we look at the mitochondrial as well as nuclear DNA conclusions, and you look at the gene map that has been drawn by several different commercial companies now that any person can participate, it does seem that everybody who considers themselves Homo sapiens living today came out of East Africa. It's just whether you're, whoever you are, whether you're from South Africa or West Africa, North Africa, or an Inuit or a Terra de Fuego person, you came from East Africa. Now, so that's one thing. I think you can set that aside as not necessarily a discovery made by the fossils, but made by people who are living now. If you start looking at the fossils and you want to go back to the origin of Homo, at the moment, the earliest recognizably modern Homo, anatomically modern Homo, are from East Africa. We have fossils from southern Ethiopia, from the Kibish in the Omo Valley, that I discovered with my team back in 1967, that date to just under 200,000 years. Similar material, slightly younger, 180,000 years, have been discovered further north in Ethiopia. And we now have it further south still in Lake Turkana in Kenya, innumerable fossils that are probably around that age that are being analyzed and studied at the moment. And there's no question that Homo sapiens proper, us, were about in plentiful numbers in eastern Africa between 150 and 200,000 years ago. Now, where you want to drive them out of, well, these people weren't in cages. They were wandering all over Africa. And we know that humans were beyond Africa from before that time. And I think we need to be patient in time to work out exactly what relates to what. But we always forget that the fossils we have are where they're found. And where they're found is where they died. And where they died doesn't mean it's the only place in Africa that they lived. And so I think we've got a somewhat skewed vision on a micro sense, although I think on the macro sense, an African origin for humanity is very, very clearly now established.
So I was reading yesterday about a failed attempt for us to go into Europe when we were colonizing the world, and that we reached Asia and lived proper in Asia before we managed to really find ourselves in Europe. Do you know why that is?
I haven't seen that particular study, but my impression is that on a micro level, various people can interpret things in a different way from others. I think the bigger picture is that Homo erectus is recognizably the only early human type that got out of Africa. That turns up in Georgia, in Northern Europe. It turns up in China and the Far East. And I think fossils of Homo erectus at about 1.5 million years actually been found here in Great Britain. So I think they were all over the place after 1.7, not much before that.
Why did Neanderthals appear to survive in areas that we couldn't?
Well, whether one thing survives in one area and doesn't seem to be present in another area, is it true? Yes, you do get clear distinctions of where certain types of things are being found, but it doesn't mean that they couldn't. I think we've got to recognize that there's all sorts of soft issues in life that might determine where you go and where you don't go. I mean, maybe you're particularly suited to a particular set of food plants which aren't there, or weren't there at the time. I think it's too early to draw huge conclusions and build great castles out of fairly modest building material at the moment.
So what do you think happened to Neanderthals?
Well, as you know, there is Neanderthal genetic material in some Europeans. There is Devonian material in other modern humans. I think as more work is done, we get more ancient DNA out of material. We're going to get a lot more things. And rather than keep saying, oh, we were wrong because we now know this, why don't we say we don't know yet?
So you were talking earlier about technological advances. How do you see that growing further? So what sort of technology would you like to see, and how has it helped paleoarchaeology and, I suppose, archaeology itself?
Well, I think one of the things that we would most like to have is a better record, have none, of ancient DNA from pre-Sapien fossils. We can't find it. Most of the mineralization seems to have eliminated any traces of organic material. Now, maybe with finer and finer tools, you can look for example, teeth, and maybe it's tucked away in the teeth, in the tooth structure between crystals, you might find something that lends itself. I mean, there are all sorts of possibilities that are being explored. And some ancient DNA going back to hominids that lived 1 million years ago and 2 million years ago, as well as those that lived 100,000 years ago, would be phenomenal in terms of understanding the full story.
Could you tell me a bit about this mega museum that you're hoping to create?
Well, I have long felt that if we now have as much evidence we have about the common origin and the shared heritage that all humans have coming out of Africa, as seen in the DNA story particularly, with fossils to support it, there needs to be somewhere where we as modern people can celebrate it, where we can see it all presented in one place, and we can actually reflect on the fact that this is our museum. It's the people of the world who came from here, and we're bringing them back to see the evidence that has accumulated. And so we're talking about building a fairly large edifice in northern Kenya that would, by in its own right, be quite impressive architecturally. It would be an icon on the continent. It would be, in some senses, a modern Egyptian pyramid, in that people would want to see it. It could be equivalent in Southeast Asia to the Sydney Opera House. It'll be architecturally dramatic. And internally, it'll have a lot of the evidence that is available to other people, but not in one place. And it will not be a place to rub your nose into the detailed understanding, but it'll be a place to celebrate on this extraordinary story of human evolution.
So you've been involved in politics, conservation and evolution. Do you feel that politicians hamper the work in any of these areas?
Politicians are simply people, and if they're not properly briefed, they can run in any direction. Politicians can be extraordinarily useful and extraordinarily irksome. But I think when they're irksome, it's largely because we haven't enabled them not to be irksome. And if they can see that it'll increase their popularity and their standing, politicians will usually support an idea. But we take it as read that they're a damn nuisance, and we shouldn't, because they can be very effective. But they are often a nuisance, I would agree.
And you come from a family of archaeologists, paleontologists and naturalists. Were you always destined to be in the same area, or was there anything else?
No, I don't think I was destined. I didn't particularly want to go to university and college, so I didn't. I wanted to be myself and didn't want to always be thought of as my parents' middle son. I wanted to get beyond being introduced as the son of Lewis and Mary, and that was perhaps more apparent in my earlier years. But no, I didn't have a real destiny. I didn't really set out to achieve any one thing. I'm an opportunist, and when something comes up that needs doing and there's a way I can do it, I get at it.
And what has been your greatest influence outside of your family?
I think the greatest influence on my life is the importance of getting people to understand things on a scientific basis. I am appalled that a continent such as Africa is trying to solve huge problems that stem from famine and drought and things that can be fixed. And the fact that science is not given priority in our education, and that there's an anti-science lobby based around their horror of evolution, this has to be fought. But it's not just true in Africa. The United States is unbelievably negative about science and things like climate change. And very distinguished people who should know better don't know any better. And they're giving leadership and mentorship to a younger generation, where they're suggesting that knowledge from science is a multiple choice. You can say, I don't like it, or I do like it. And nothing could be more stupid. There is always going to be why things happen. And if we know what the why is, we can perhaps do better at making the world more habitable in the future.
Lastly, how do you feel about Angelina Jolie wanting to make a film about your life?
Well, I didn't really know Angelina Jolie, and I didn't really believe that this was something that might happen. It hasn't happened, but it probably will. Idea that could do enormous good for Africa if it could bring audiences to elephants and get people to understand what's going on in prehistory and human origins, and she wants to make a film that incorporates both.
Dr. Richard Leakey speaking to Rowan Slaney at the Royal Society in London.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Now Nicola Davis joins me in the pod to look at this week's science news stories. Nicola, what's caught your eye?
Well, this week there was an interesting story about the NHS, who are funding a study, in fact the world's largest study, into the effect of aspirin on cancer and whether aspirin can prevent the recurrence of certain cancers in patients.
And how long is this going to go on for? When are we likely to get the results of this?
Well, not any time soon is the quick answer. So the study could take up to 12 years, and within that, the participants will be taking their aspirin or placebo or whatever it is that they're being given in the trial daily for 5 years. It's going to involve around 11,000 patients. So this is a big study, and it's going to be across, I think it's more than 100 centres in the UK. So it's really trying to be very thorough in what they're doing so we can actually at the end of it come out with some idea of whether this really works or whether it doesn't. And they're also looking at two different dosages for the patients that will be taking aspirin. So obviously this is a randomised controlled trial, so there'll be placebos involved. But of the people who will be taking aspirin, there are then two doses. There's either 100 milligrams or 300 milligrams. So they're really trying to look not only at whether aspirin can reduce the likelihood of recurring cancers, but also how that's changed with dosage, because there have been lots of studies in the past about aspirin and cancer and lots of potentially positive conclusions being drawn, but it does seem to depend upon the dosage, perhaps unsurprisingly, and it does also depend upon whether that's taken every day, every other day, how long. It's been a lot of controversy about exactly what the optimum is, so they're trying to answer some of those questions with this study.
So these people taking part in the trial will have had cancer before, is that right? And what
Yes.
sort of cancers are we talking about?
So they'll either have recently had or will still be being treated for a range of cancers. And these are bowel cancer, breast cancer, esophageal cancer, prostate cancer, or actually even stomach cancer. So there are very particular kinds that they're looking at. So it's trying to see whether there are certain cancers which will respond better to this or not. So it's really trying to be quite a broad study to try to get the most out of it.
There have been studies in the past that have suggested that taking aspirin, fairly low dose aspirin, for many years can delay the onset or prevent cancer of different types. How do scientists think aspirin might be working?
Well, there's a couple of different mechanisms. So we don't know absolutely for sure which mechanism is working, but there's a couple of hypotheses out there which seem pretty reasonable. One is the fact that aspirin reduces inflammation. And so if you reduce the inflammation, that can decrease the growth of new blood vessels in an area and can decrease the chance of mutations in DNA happening, both of which can contribute to the development of cancers. So that's one approach, is sort of the reduction in inflammation. Another theory which has been put out there is the fact that it's thought that aspirin can reduce the transport of cancer cells around the body, so it can stop cancer spreading, essentially. So there are a couple of different mechanisms by which it's thought that aspirin could work. This study doesn't appear to be looking at probing that particularly, but it's looking more at whether patients will actually receive some benefit or not from taking aspirin in this way. Because, of course, there should be pointed out that there are side effects to taking aspirin. So they're not suggesting that we should all rush out now to the pharmacy and start buying boxes on the off chance it's going to help. They're sort of cautioning that we shouldn't go around taking matters into our own hands. So this is why they're doing this study. They want to be able to say with some level of confidence about who's going to benefit from this.
But then with this study, it will still only really be relevant to people who've had cancer before, and whether aspirin is effective perhaps or advisable for people to prevent it coming back, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. It's definitely in patients who are already suffering or have suffered from these conditions. It's not in healthy patients. And there have been studies before that have looked at whether taking aspirin can actually prevent cancer in the first place from in healthy individuals. And again, the results from that have been mixed. There's some very positive studies out there which seem to suggest that there is some benefit. But there's still, of course, lots of work to be done and certainly lots of work to be done in healthy patients.
Well, do come back on the pod in 2027 and give us the results.
Okay, Ian, over to you. What is it that you saw in the news this week that piqued your interest?
So there was a study from the University of Leipzig and other places in Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences where the researchers looked at this idea that birth order might have some impact on your personality. And there are a whole load of sort of myths around this, or ideas, I suppose you could say, floating around that whether you're firstborn or lastborn or a middle child, or have some kind of gentle nudge on the personality and the person you come to be later in life. So one idea out there is that the firstborns are supposedly more responsible and dominating, and that later-born children might be a bit more rebellious, a bit more sociable. And some people say that middle children are a bit more relaxed, that they're not actually competing as much as the, say, firstborns or lastborns. Now, a lot of these different ideas are bandied around by people, and these scientists really just wanted to see whether there was any sense of that coming through when you look at a lot of people.
So how exactly did they test this? It sounds like a lot of these ideas are sort of based on urban myth and anecdote. So how do they actually subject this to any sort of scrutiny?
So they looked at what psychologists will call the five big personality traits, which are things like openness, agreeableness, neuroticism, conscientiousness, and extroversion. And they looked at these from questionnaires essentially given to about 20,000 adults from the US, the UK, and Germany. And these were looking at children who had different numbers of siblings and were obviously, you know, had different birth orders. And so they were just quite keen to see whether any of these classic personality traits were increased or decreased in any kind of meaningful way when you look at birth order. And lo and behold, they found that there was no statistical difference in how these people's personalities seemed to come out on questionnaires.
So they didn't find any difference in personality type. There was no effect of which order you're born on that. But what about in terms of things like IQ? Is there any correlation between the order of siblings and their IQ levels?
So pretty large studies in the past have shown that birth order has some slight effect on IQ, and that the firstborn tends to be score marginally higher, very marginally higher on an IQ score. These researchers looked at IQ just as a way of sort of ground truthing their data, because if they could pick up that trend, then they mm-hmm. knew their study was pretty well on track for measuring these other personality traits. So they found that, say, the difference between a firstborn and a secondborn would typically be, say, one IQ point, maybe 1.5 IQ points. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was talking to the researchers, they said, well, the thing is, that is actually pretty much within the error margins of an IQ test itself. So an IQ test itself may have an error of a couple of points either way. These differences are there. It may be that the first child just gets more attention, more encouragement that sets them up better, perhaps, for that sort of intellectual activity, but it's incredibly marginal. And again, this is only works on a population level. It's not that this is going to be the case for every individual. It just means that, you know, you would expect, if there was no difference, you would expect something like, you know, 50-50 for the firstborn to be more intelligent than the secondborn, and this would probably put that to 40-60. It doesn't mean that, you know, the secondborn is always going to be dimmer than the firstborn. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Richard Leakey, Rowan Slaney, and Nicola Davis. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.